Another Holden Forum, which we have at least once a week, sometimes more often, during the summer. My name is David Wee. I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators at Holden for this summer, and it's my role tonight to be the moderator of the forum. As you have heard in the announcements and seen on the kiosk board, our topic tonight is racism at Holden. The topics for Holden forums often arise out of issues that emerge at class discussions during the day and during the week, and out of discussions amongst faculty and staff at Holden. And we decided this week to take up this topic. I think most of us recognize that racism has been and continues to be one of the most perplexing and frustrating and damaging issues in all of human relations. And it's important for us to examine this issue wherever we are from time to time and try to understand honestly how we are participating in racism wherever we are. We've got three people tonight who are going to begin our discussion for us. Margaret Lovejoy, Verlon Brown, and Peter Nash. And we'll ask them to talk in that order. And each of them will say some things for 5 or 6 or 8 minutes, basically to set some issues on the table and perhaps explain some experiences or help us understand some of the issues more clearly. But please understand that a forum at Holden belongs to all of us, that this is for all of us to participate in, and those of us up at this part of the circle here are only here to get us started. The only rule we have during our forums at Holden is that we listen to one another with respect. Sometimes we disagree sharply on whatever the topic happens to be, and that's a healthy and normal thing to have us disagree or to question one another. But we insist here that we do that with respect for all others in the room. So let's begin. Margaret has agreed to start out for us.
Okay. Well, since I truly believe and understand that racism is alive and well in America, then I also believe that racism is alive and well at Holden Village. I heard this summer that a good explanation, what I feel for myself is a good explanation of prejudice and racism. And prejudice means to prejudge. Before we gather information, we prejudge. If I don't like orange, I would look at you and say, I don't like you because you're wearing an orange blouse. So I'm prejudging before I even ask you what your name is. Racism is economic and social financial power to enforce that prejudgment. So if I feel that I'm rich enough and powerful enough, I can hold it over you and say, I don't like you, and make you feel it. And I think in the 90s, that's for myself, that's how racism comes to being, is by feeling. Living in an educated and sophisticated society such as Holden Village, it's difficult to pinpoint a racist act most times. But there's a level of feeling in which I know exactly how I feel when I hit these acts of racism. And I'd like to say to you very concretely, this is what it is, but I can't. I can give you one example. This summer, my intention when I came to Holden Village was I knew I could not change the population, the color of the population of Holden Village overnight. I mean, that is a slow process, and it will be, it has to be very intentional and real focused on changing that. And I would never say that I can do that by myself. But my intention was to make sure that all people of color were represented at Holden Village throughout the summer. And I think every week we have had a person of color on teaching staff, and that was my intention. Next year I hope we have more than just one, that we have a real good balance of people of color on teaching staff. And I chose teaching staff because with the help of Rolan, we talked it through, and I feel that teaching staff can share information with you, and then you take it back to your homes and your families, your congregations, your community, and start to understand what is happening in America to people of color through that Holden experience like that. The women that have come to Holden Village this summer, and I think there have been five women of color, four women of color, they came to Holden Village. The first being Dorothy, and she and I got together and discovered that many people had called her Margaret and had called me Dorothy. When Annie Paul came, I was called Annie, she was called Margaret. John Irma was called Margaret. These are all black women. I was called John Irma. Now, when Dove was here, I was not called Dove, but Dove was called Margaret. An example of people not looking at the person, but looking at this block, this female block, seeing that it's black, and having a name and putting it. It doesn't matter. You're black, you're a woman, you must be Margaret. You're black, you're a woman, you must be. And it's that blindness that to me feels racist, that there are people that don't take the time to look at who I am enough to say, oh, you don't look anything like John Irma. You are different. That hurts.
May I say that?
Yeah.
I made the mistake of calling your beautiful daughter Margaret, but I saw her.
But
from,
we look alike.
I saw her from the back, and
we
I was filming. But anyway, that wasn't what I was saying. I was going to say I look at all these men, white men here with long beard and long hair, and I can't tell one from the other too a lot of times. So it isn't just something that has to do with. With black women, believe me, I mean, to me, a lot of these guys look the same, and I cannot remember their names, you know.
But if you would look at Annie Paul, and if you look at John Irma, and if you would look at Dorothy,
okay.
And myself.
I didn't know, but you do look
like are not. My daughter and I look alike.
She doesn't have gray hair.
Right.
Can we all jump in here?
Well, why don't we wait mainly till the three have finished, and then we'll
But if you look at us, we look nothing alike. And it's not just Holden Village that this happens.
That's right.
It happens everywhere. And that, to me, is one of those subtle issues of racism that happens throughout the United States. I feel the results of racism here at Holden Village by the power structure of who has the power at Holden Village, not so much with probably the guests, but in the structure, that the intention of making Holden Village multicultural has to be a focused endeavor, and what you say, this is where we're going to put our energy, if that is what Holden Village plans to do, and it is something that has to be very intentional.
I agree with Margaret that racism lives and breathes at Holden. One of the things that strikes me is that How many of you have seen or read an article entitled White Privilege? Is anyone? Well, anyway, in this article, it talks about white privilege, and it talks about, it lists 25 things that's a part of white privilege. The fact that you can go anywhere and cash a check, and it's not assumed that that check is bad. You can watch TV and read the news media and see your people represented in ways other than just negative ways. Even to buying what used to be called flesh-colored Band-Aids. And crayons, too, although now they come out with world-colored crayons as opposed to represent the colors of the people in the world. But those subtle privileges that whites have, and she listed only 25 of them, and there are more, but as an African-American to sit at Holden and continually witness those privileges that whites have that I don't have creates a subtle form of racism. And why I say that is because those privileges allow people to be egocentric. By egocentric, I mean centered on the self, to assume that the self is the center of the universe. And I think that many of the white people here feel that they are the center of the universe, in the sense that there's a lack of intolerance for anything that's not white. An example, we had some kids up here. We had a connection in Portland, Oregon. An African-American pastor would bring up inner-city youth four times a year for them to experience Holden. And we have dances here all the time at Holden. But this particular time, the youth happened to come and coincide with a dance. So they said, can we play some of our music? And we said, of course, you know. And I was playing the music. And there was just a lack, just a total intolerance for African-American music. When it was played, the whites would sit down and only the blacks would dance. When white music was played or crossover music was played, the whites would get up and dance. The blacks would continue to dance. And eventually, the whites would, you know, begin to whine and say, you know, could you play more of this? Unless it was difficult for them to not have control of the music. It was difficult for the whites not to have control of that music. And I think that privilege, which leads to egocentrism, which leads to intolerance. Plus what Margaret says, the power that is built in the structure of Holden for whites, I think that that creates racism. Because everybody who comes here who's not white has to eat white, talk white, dress white, you know, in order to fit in. And if you don't, there's a certain amount of intolerance to that. And my last point is, I think that here at Holiness, elsewhere, there is a hate even for things that are black. An assumption that all things black are inferior. A feeling for blacks who show up that first you have to prove yourself before we can deal with you face to face. And I think there's a hatred of all things black just built into our society And we, of course, bring that public with us.
Okay, Peter?
What they said. I joked with Verlon that I was going to play the role of the guy who said, well, I don't know what the problem is. I don't see any racism here at Holden. But this is my third summer up here, and I don't have nearly the experience that they have with this particular place. But the makeup of the teaching staff and the kinds of things that we tend to teach up here are the things that I noticed most about what, just how we teach, and whom we ask to teach. That this is an extremely well-educated group. I constantly find myself in a kind of a funny situation. All of my students are master's students or above, and I come up here and I teach people who are pretty typically better educated than my master's level students. In a country where a BA is still not the majority, and the majority of the people still don't earn a BA, this makes us a very upper middle class and therefore Anglo type audience to teach to. And that means that we're going to continue to have difficulty in recruiting staff that aren't out of those categories, or that category. And it's going to be an uninviting place for people who aren't in those categories. Those of you who have worked on advanced degrees know that feeling of suddenly being in a room of people in the next tier above you. If you're working on your BA, to be with people who all have their BA and are working on their master's, or if you're working on your master's, to be with people who all have their master's and are working on their PhD, or if you're working on your PhD to be around people who all have their PhD and are working on tenure or whatever, to just step into that room is a very difficult thing to do. Added to that, the emphases that are here, the care of creation, not an idea that I have a problem with, but
emphasis on what?
The care of creation, ecology. The kinds of activities that one is able to participate in, relaxing, artistic, weaving, pottery, hiking, they're not the kinds of things that most, and not to say that all people of color in the United States are below working class in their income level, but they're not typically the kinds of things that people have been exposed to if they're not Anglos. And that means that Holden is, again, an uninviting place. So the education level and the expectations about what you're going to hear in the classrooms and the kinds of activities that are available just make, how else can you say it, but this, in its very focus and its foci, is an upper-class, white, liberal institution, which is hard to hear as a comment about racism, but that is probably the place in which the institution of racism is best driven. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, the slaveholder, was the classic upper-class liberal, although I just read the other day that they had to hold a lottery to bail him out at one point. Liberalism is not, likes to think of itself as being without racism, but it's as full of it as the rest of the country. And again, as Verlon said, we bring it upriver. And how to change that, the only way to change that is to, in some ways, dramatically change the character of Holden Village. The kinds of music that one hears, it seems to me that we're a lot more comfortable and excited about South African or Chilean music than we are about Mexican-American, African-American music. That's a little too close to home. It's in most cases, it's easy to worry about somebody out there that we're never going to deal with face-to-face or dealt with through a really nice experience when we were juniors in college than the people who we think might be lifting the stereo out of our car or just hanging around outside our offices. So the nature of the place itself is a problem as far as I see it, especially in its the foci and the people who we ask to teach. One other thing about that is as I've begun to invite people for next summer to the teaching staff, and one of the directives I got from Scott, and Margaret and I have talked about it a couple times on the phone and when she's been out this past year, is to recruit people of color. And this is where the whole system in the United States, even this upper class Anglo-oriented educational system, puts us into another bind, and that is, since this is a volunteer staff across the board, in my field in biblical studies, there are only 27 African Americans with PhDs in the field of biblical studies, teaching in seminaries in the United States. So that right there limits the number of people you can ask if you want that kind of a teaching staff. It also means that of those, probably 7 to 10 have tenure and can do what they please, and the rest are at some stage of finishing degrees or earning tenure and have to be very careful about what kinds of invitations they can accept. And as you all know, taking 2 weeks, 3 weeks away from your regular schedule of writing, teaching, whatever it is, daily life, to come someplace like this, where you can't get there from here, from the East Coast, means that they have to make a very sometimes painful decision about what they're going to write during the summer. If it's not something that's going to be directly applicable to their tenure review or their promotion review, or as is the case since these people are so typically so overworked, oversubscribed, why come to Holden for 3 weeks and maybe if there's a generous day get part of your expenses paid when you could in 3 days make, you know, $1,500 to $3,000 out on the speaking circuit. And because these people tend to have more loans to pay off, the choice is usually, I don't think I'm going to volunteer right now. I have other places to volunteer that are closer to home and meet my community's needs more closely. The situation in my field is even more dire in the Hispanic American community. Fewer people credentialed in the field. And in the Asian community, again, fewer people credentialed in the field. So those are the kinds of things that we're dealing with. That last piece is a pitch for when Scott writes you this fall and winter and asks you for money. You might think about making a bigger donation and earmarking it for teaching staff of color.
Okay, thanks to all three of you. I have to apologize to all of you. Normally I ask the presenters to introduce who they are beyond their names at the beginning, and I forgot to ask you to do that.
Because we're black.
But I want to tell you that Margaret Lovejoy is the Holden Village Program Director and has lived here at Holden for over a year and will be here at least one more year. Verlon Brown is a Lutheran pastor who has been the Holden Village pastor for the past 3 years. And Peter Nash is a theologian at Garrett Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. And as you can tell, he is going to be the one in charge of the summer teaching staff next year. And apologize for not having told you that before they spoke rather than after. And the other thing that is to let you know that we finish our forms at 10 o'clock formally, so that you can just know that that's when the formal time will end, and I'll make it easy for you to leave, but frequently people stay and continue talking about the issues or carry on the discussion beyond tonight, and you're welcome to do that. But now we're open to comments, questions, observations from anybody until 10 o'clock. Ron?
Just a question. Margaret said, and I, from what experience I've had, it's certainly true that an effort to change these patterns, especially against the odds, which you all, you know, said in different ways, how bad the odds are, has to be focused, has to be intentional, has to be methodical. And what those words, of course, I mean, for my mind, is that's essentially why institutions, organizations have affirmative action programs. I mean, that's one way to say why institutions have them. They've tried to make methodical and very, make requirements out of wishes and aspirations in order to, in a way, in order to fight the odds. Does Holden have anything in the way of an affirmative action program at any level in terms of staff, et cetera, et cetera? And if not, is that something that can be explored in the next year? Is that something that has been discussed in the board or wherever? I don't even know the, this is my first time voting, so I'm really.
For 6 months, we had a man here, Ted Hutchinson, who drew up a plan to do multicultural outreach and to help us with that. He was here as a volunteer for 6 months, drew up a wonderful plan, and there is not really the staff to work that plan. I do not have that much time in my day to work that plan. Scott is, while he is out, is going to try to start to reach some of those. But no, we really don't have any one person now that will be their focus. And that's what we need. We need that one person. And probably not a person that lives at Holden Village. We need an outside person who is dedicated to intentionally working toward making Holden Village multiracial, multicultural.
But this plan you're saying was a good plan, or is a good plan. It is an accepted plan now by the board, or how does it work in Holden?
Yeah, the board.
And does it have goals, concrete? I mean, because affirmative action generally is quite specific, and I think it's in the specificity in some ways that right. Part of the fight is you make some progress, but we make some progress.
His plan is for outreach to change who comes to Holden Village, who the guests are. That's basically the plan, and step by step by step, how you make the invitation, who makes the invitation, how you have to stay on it, be very conscientious about staying on it. Sensitivity training to staff, after you get guests of color here, that the staff has to be trained in sensitivity. That we have to look at what we are saying in our teaching sessions. As Peter said, there are issues here that I think people of color just would not be really gung-ho about coming to Holden Village to listen to. So we have to look at our programming, what we're offering. All of these things. And when they get here, not only does the staff have to be sensitive, but we have to be very, very careful how we integrate them into the life of Holden Village. They don't just get off the bus and you say, here it is, you know, go to it. You have to be very intentional, having a host or whatever you call a person, bringing them into the village. And yes, you have to do special care for groups or people that come here. It's getting off the bus and falling into a completely white community is difficult. It's very difficult.
Question?
Yeah, I mean, does it also deal with, Peter, you spoke to this. I mean, the questions of, you talked about a little bit, but about the culture of Holden is not only just the classes. It's not only what's taught, but the culture of this place that is not necessarily a place where people of color would, not that everybody's the same, but there's a lot of things about Holden that are sort of white middle class culturally and sort of eco kind of thing and everything. Does it talk about that at all, or how do you feel? How does this person address that when thinking of outreach?
Not really the culture. I don't think he dealt with the culture of Holden.
I mean, do you think that's an issue too?
Oh yeah, it is.
What kind of things that are going on now would black people not be interested in?
We're not just talking about black people, we're talking about all, all the people of color, who people of color are.
There are so many different things going on. Some are not be interested in some of the things. And
I think that, for example, there's a whole, not only, because people have mentioned not only racism, but classism as part of what is Holden's whole culture of upper middle class, Lutheran kind of liberalism, is that do we do classes on being a single mother in today's world? Or, you'd have to have enough single mothers here for one thing to be interested in going to that class. And or would you do a workshop on living in the inner city, how can I build community on my block? Or, and I think that there's a whole lot of different things, not only for people of color, but for people with different incomes that would be much different than studying what we have to offer now.
And there's a point, if you would start to offer class sessions like that, then the outcry would come. Holden is changing. It's not like it used to be. Well, yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, the food thing is an interesting thing. I mean, it's new for me to experience the kind of food, but it's not a totally alien thing. But I would have appreciated, even from where I come from, on the issue of the kind of food, some more interpretation of it, some more explanation, some more sense of, well, why are we doing this? And then sort of accepting the challenge, but what it almost seemed like it's just assumed, like this is it, And I've liked it, and I've thought about it some, and I said to Carol, don't tell my friends or something, that I like the food, and I ate yogurt and granola. But not assuming it, it seems to me, is very important. Not assuming that everybody knows that this is, I don't know what it is, the future or something,
Lower food chain.
There's a whole lot of high fiber, low fat, meatless meals that come out of Southern and black tradition that, in my, not third year, but only 5 weeks now, haven't seen here.
Aha, uh-huh. So that's interesting.
I was thinking of that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of good food they could have.
I haven't seen greens since I've been.
Right.
Yeah. Once token green meal.
So that sort of thing is one thing.
Yeah.
Another place is worship. Worship is very middle class here. You read from the moment you get in to the moment you get out.
And the one exception that I've seen to that is Deaf and Hard of Hearing Week.
Yeah.
Where there's still a lot of reading, but there's a real focus on attacking other senses or meeting other senses than just the oral and the visual.
And our South African worship service, I mean, when we first started that, people were really offended. We had to explain drums, We had to say to people that in other countries, the drum is a symbol of earth and a symbol of the moon, and it's respected. When we first started doing drums here, people were offended by it. We used, oftentimes with the South African worship, we do a drumming prelude and a drumming postlude. And people were offended by that. And some people, it was like, if we were playing a prelude on the organ, people would be quiet. When we were doing prelude with the drums, people just kept talking, walking around like nothing was going on. So, you know,
which is more culturally consistent, by the way?
Well, that's our ignorance. But isn't that part of our ignorance?
Ignorance, yes, instead right. Of no. Ignorance.
Yeah,
that's the.
But you know, when I was here 23 years ago, all this change business, people talked about it then too. Oh my God, the white community is horrified that we're having a silent sermon. We are not going to speak a word for 5 minutes, and we made everybody sit there. And if they were going to zone out and feel great, they could do that. If they were going to be uncomfortable, they were going to do that. But that was a thing about Holden that really encouraged me religiously. Was that at some point I felt that it was encouraging.
Maybe it's
that
a good thing to be on
place
it. Maybe it's
where
a good
people
thing
would say, yeah, you could do
you
that.
To squirm a little bit. Maybe that's good for us.
That's right.
Definitely. And until people of all races make each other squirm in all kinds of situations, I don't think much is going to get done.
But
here,
also
of all places, I think it's certainly
well, well,
how,
was here.
How is the white community going to squirm
exactly
if we can't get people of color to be
that's
here?
Right.
What's
right.
going
and
to cause you to squirm?
Well, when Will Hertzfeld was here, I didn't see people leaving here in droves. I thought they came here to see, to be able to take part in that type of an activity. And it, sure, I know I felt at the time I was almost embarrassed, and why should I be? But that's good, and it didn't keep me from not coming back.
Will Hertzfeld was here, and he was, you know, he was part of the staff
yeah.
and everything. But Will Hertzfeld was not part of the power structure.
That's right.
And Holden needs to share the power, mm-hmm. meaning people of color as director, people of color as editor, village pastor, program staff, you know.
Board of directors.
Board of directors, yeah. I mean, we really don't recruit from anywhere where there are African-American students. We don't make an effort to go out and recruit those people. And the reality of it is what it is to be white American is hostile to people who are not white Americans. I have sisters who will not come up here, you know, because they say they're not going anywhere where they're surrounded by white people. You can't get out only by boat.
That's not
and
funny.
Tell you what
that
to
really
eat.
Is not funny.
No,
it's funny.
It's true. So we have to make some kind of an effort. There are students of color at PLU. There are some students of color, even at St. Olaf. There are students of color at Augustan, you know. But we don't seem to make any effort to reach those students and get them here on volunteer staff. I was on volunteer staff for 3 years before I came here, and I was always the only black person on volunteer staff in the summer of 76, 77, and 83. I was the only black person on staff.
Well, they met the affirmative action goals.
Yeah.
But in terms of worship, I want to go back to that for a minute because I was rummaging around to thinking about planning Vespers next week and looking for, you know, what hymn books are here and what resources do you have. And at least what I found, and I know, you know, I didn't talk to you, Ron, but you know, sort of showed me what was around, and I was really amazed at the lack of African American tradition, the new hymnals. I know this is a resource issue too, like you have money to buy these things, but I was wondering if there's, you know, if this has been raised, and you know, why there were some hymns that I was thinking about, and we don't have the, you know, the hymns that and the books that you know that I was thinking about using. Some of them, you know, and I know they're not in our LBW, and sometimes you have to get them different kind of hymnals, but
well, that was an issue we dealt with this year, and we decided rather than to buy yet another book, the book we were looking at was Lead Me, Guide Me,
right.
And we decided rather than to buy yet another book that we would take those hymns from that book and other resources and kind of have a Holden songbook, because that would be cheaper in the long run.
Maybe get copyright permissions and stuff.
Yeah. And I wrote and called and got copyright permissions, and it's in the making, now. But that's
another thing you might try. There is what Mary was doing the other night, and that is, you know, lining out the songs, which is another, you know, for Lutherans is sort of jarring, but for Methodists and AMEs and CMEs and Baptists, it's just the way you sing. Lining up the songs, where there's a song leader who sings out the line.
Oh, I see, the line.
Half a beat ahead, so that you can then call and response, sort of.
And that's a way of dealing with, you know, all the reading that that educated people can do well. Dealing with the call and response and cut out a lot of the liturgy stuff or change it. I mean, you can say the Lord be with you, and also, you know, people know that. They don't really have to read that. But if you take away some of that liturgy, then people will say, you know, you're not Lutheran anymore. And then that becomes...
Just a side note on this, two kids that I've noticed here this week. Well, one is my daughter, who I notice all the time. She, you know, she's 10 years old and just doesn't read very well. She has Down syndrome. And there's a blind girl here this week. Mm-hmm. And two entire categories that have very little to do with race that are excluded from this particular worship style.
Kathy, you've had your hand up.
Yeah, I think it's more. This is more of an academic surrounding and more of a politically liberal place, more than it has to do with whether people of color or not. My parents are, they're white and they're middle class and they're even Lutheran. And they find very little offered that they would be interested in here, and they don't like the diet. And so it's something else other than color, I think.
But they don't feel awkward getting off the bus, because people wouldn't look at them and say,
it's not an attractive place to them, and it's not, you know.
No, I understand that.
Of things, and there's nothing.
But Kathy, there's a way that I think white people have to be able to listen to people of color say what they say and then believe it. Mm-hmm. And not say, well, that's happened to me, or,
right,
oh, that happens to me when I look at men with beards. I mean, you have to just be able to say, oh, that
it's
must
true.
Be true then.
But I think there's something more to it.
Well, there's obviously, yeah, a whole cultural thing happening here too. That's,
yes.
Well, I just, I'm from Denmark, but we don't really have call up people.
You have Finns, though.
We have about in the military, and I would say all the black young men that I have met in the military have been polite, helpful, you know, just very much so. In Washington, D.C., we commute on bus from one place to the other, and the only people I saw get up for old ladies, non-black, were black young men. Now, the only problem I have, I'm sorry, Margaret, are with the black women, and I'll just give you a couple of experiences. And I have kind of a, you know, I say everything, I mean, sometimes I guess I don't think, but I have a kind of a English type sense of humor, and I'll just give you two examples, and that makes me afraid of saying, of treating black people the way I would white, because I thought, oh my gosh, they got offended, you know. And like one example was, I worked a place, and I had this black young supervisor. She was a very, very nice young lady, and she was from British, one of the British West Indian Islands. And every week we had a kind of a thing we had to fill out, you know, how did we like our supervisor, how did we like our work, or blah, 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 you know. And she was helping me, and not thinking, just saying what I would have said to a white person. I said, oh yeah, you're a regular slave driver. Oh yeah, that was the wrong thing to say, you know, but I didn't do it on purpose. I just didn't think. I said what I would have said to a white person, you know. Another time I worked in a college, and this black gentleman, he came through my tech stand this morning and had coffee, and we got to know each other, and we were kind of, you know, how are you and how's your day and blah, 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 you know. So one day he had a black lady with him, and he had not to have enough money, and I said, oh, well, yeah, you can go out and do dishes, ha, 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 you know. And he ha, 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 too. And the black lady said, well, you're not going to tell him to do dishes. So, oh, God, you know, the wrong thing again, you know. So, you know, I just say, hey, you see what I'm saying? I'm afraid of saying the right thing. I feel that I can't say the same to a black, especially women, that I would say to a white person because I'm not even understanding. Well, maybe I have a point.
You can't.
You have to think about what you're saying.
And I can't say the same thing to you.
But you understand what I'm saying?
I understand, but I'm saying you can't. And I'm saying I can't talk to you people to where I would talk to my people.
Because you would be offended.
But what would you say, like, when...
Well, I don't know.
let me give one example from junior high school. My sort of real kick in the face about racism. I was a Lutheran youth group deal at the beach, and walking down the street with one of my Lutheran colleagues, there was this really nice red sports car on the beach, and I just looked at the car and looked at Dave, who was with me, and looked at the guy who I thought owned the car, and I said, "This is a really nice car." And this guy was just, you know, he's an exception. His response was, "What did you say, nigger?"
Oh.
And he was, you know, I was 13, he was 16, he was ready to pound me into the ground because for some reason on that day, he had a beef with maybe the world, but I was an acceptable place to take it out. We can't say the same things, and the response to our saying the wrong thing, which is sometimes even in that case, a genuine compliment, is to get our faces kicked into the ground.
Yeah, but see, that's what I don't get. I mean, like if we can't speak the same language and treat each other just like whatever, I mean, if we were blind, we would know who we were talking to.
I think one of the issues that you're talking about that possibly needs to be addressed inside the village, we don't all come from the same geographic locations in the United States. I come from metropolitan LA, and there are things that you do and can do and can't do in metropolitan LA that you wouldn't dream of doing or even have a desire to do in anywhere in the Midwest. It just one of the things that I was talking with Carol today on bilingual services. It seems, from my perspective, bilingual services are a big issue in those areas of the country that have that kind of population. Southern California, mid-California, where you have large agricultural communities. Texas, again, where you have large agricultural communities. You also have the border between Texas and Mexico. In South Dakota, I'm not sure that bilingual services and bilingual education is an issue. A place like Holden needs to make that an issue for those communities where it is not yet an issue, but it will be an issue.
Another issue for Holden that I see also is that I work in the kitchen now since I'm easing out as Phyllis Pastor. And I work with women who are half my age, and they're all white, and they're giving me directions, and, you know, I do it. But most white people are not used to taking directions from people of color.
That's right.
Most white people are almost offended, you know, or question one's authority if somebody asks you to do something or you know, request that something should, you know, should be done. And to me, that's a real primary thing in terms of racism. You know, when you can't see that person of color as somebody who is in authority and can make decisions, you know, and you can follow those decisions without questioning it, you know, or assuming that that this person may not be the one in charge.
Let me tell another tacky experience story. I was interviewing at Gettysburg Seminary, and part of the interview process in almost every academic institution these days is to have interviews with students, leaders of the student body. And I met with three students, one of whom was the president of the student body. And this was a position for black scholars. I mean, Gettysburg was, I guess they'd gotten behind Philadelphia Seminary. Philadelphia had two black scholars and they didn't have any yet, so they had to go find one. And the president of the student body actually said to me, well, let's face it, you haven't been through the most strenuous of sifting processes to come to this interview. sifting process. Now, I have a great deal of respect for Lutheran seminaries. I think most of them do a really good job, and at least in collecting faculty from good institutions. But I was just stunned that someone who was at a regional seminary from a regional college would say to someone who'd been to two major universities, major research institutions in this country, that because he came through a specific search for a black scholar, that he had not been through an extensive sifting process.
Unbelievable.
My background is the University of Chicago and Princeton Theological Seminary, which are, I'll say, two of the giants in theological education in the United States. This kid, who is, I'm sure, now a well-respected pastor in central Pennsylvania. just didn't know what he was saying. I mean, he didn't know he was making one of those really goofy, dumb remarks because of this sense of privilege that Roland talked about in his opening statement.
You had a comment.
The issue of authority and gaining credibility in any setting, but we're talking about here at Holden Village in a primarily white middle class setting. There's code words, code behaviors, whatever. People like myself, white middle class, are used to seeing, you know, a pastor a certain way. And if you don't fit right in that box, then, you know, your credibility isn't there because you're not, you know, and it's not conscious, it's just that's the box that we say people of authority are white male people who talk a certain way and act a certain way and interact a certain way. And I think that people like me need to be challenged to saying that's not the only way to be credible. There are other behaviors, there's other foundations to be a leader in a community like Holden Village, other than having to fit in that particular definition. And I don't know how to get that consciousness out to the people who come to Holden, but that's what I think you, for a lot of, you know, up against.
I want to get back a little bit to the issue of personal interaction and how it is that you know, we don't offend each other. And I think what we have to recognize is that everybody, you know, everybody that we interact with has a personal story. And that to have good communication, as much as we can sort of know about their personal story or find out or not make assumptions, I think is the name of the game, whether the person is blind, whether the person has just lost their husband, whether whatever. And that in terms of people of color, that there are groups of people where you could say the same thing about gays and lesbians, or to a certain extent women, but I put that in a little different category. But there's also a collective story as well as the personal story of what that group of people has experienced, and that we have to know that, and that we also have to know, that's why it's important to know about racism, and it's important to know about the history of our country and our awareness of our own racism, so that in our interactions, we, you know, we're not making that we're somewhat informed by, you know, this person has history. I may not know, you know, Verlon's personal history, you know, I heard a little bit on 29 or whatever, but I know that he's black, so that I know that there's a certain history there that I just know because of the color of his skin. Now another person, you know, I may not know that their husband died last week or something, but that we have to, you know, we have to interact with people on the basis of knowing there's a history there, and that some people said, you know, easy to see because of their color, you know, but, you know, other people it's not as easy to see. But I think we have to own that and realize that that's a history of oppression, and we've been part of that.
When I talked about egocentricity, from my experience, from what I've gathered, only white people ever assume that you can talk to someone of a different race, of a different country, and use the same jokes in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not even an assumption. I don't, mm-hmm. I wouldn't think for most people of color. You know.
And it's not always an assumption for white people if they're going to a different country.
Yeah.
1,000 years or so ago, I was in the Peace Corps in Turkey, and before you go there, you learn, you know, they taught us how not to be offensive to the Turks. And here, white people assume that we don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's not a necessity. And yet it is a different language within our own country, within different peoples, and that may be also with people of handicap or you know, someone whose husband died or whatever, but it's definitely different between any kind of people of color and white people because we simply don't know.
Before I came here, I worked in Washington, D.C., and I worked with homeless people. And we had what's known as LVC, Lutheran Volunteer Corps, Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and they were young people out of college who came to work at our agencies and in various agencies in Washington, D.C. And the hardest thing to get those kids to do was to understand that black people were different than white people, that African American people were not white people gone bad, you know, that they didn't like to dress this way, you know, they didn't want to talk this way, you know, this was their life. You don't go to Spain and sit around and say, my God, look at these people, look at these clothes they're wearing. You know, you say, well, that's interesting. This is how Spaniards dress, you know. But that same kind of respect does not exist between whites and blacks across the board. So.
When I bring in sensitivity trainers to the Holman Village, I know there'll be a huge outcry that we don't need this.
Hmm.
We know how to treat people, and they don't.
And we are the most liberal people we've ever met from our families, the ones that come to Holman. I just want to, on the collective identity, caution us for a moment that there's the individual and then there are regional differences. Just like all the white folk you know aren't the same. Blacks on the coast look at those of us from the Midwest and cannot figure out how we can get along in that Midwestern culture. And we look at folks on the coast, each of the coast, in different ways and say, my God, how do you survive in this stuff? Mm-hmm. So there are some similarities, class assumptions and so on, but let's not make the mistake that because some things are shared that we're all coming at this the same way. Some of us in the Midwest like khaki pants. Yeah.
It's almost 10 o'clock, and there are two more people who've been trying to get in, and so let's hear
I
them.
Wanted to say that before I came this evening, we just learned about it, that I was uneasy. 25 years ago, when I attended sessions like this, people with my complexion were so terribly defensive. And first we'd say, well, come and talk with us tell us where we've done wrong, and then as soon as you say something, we say, oh, but that's not us. And I'm pleased that we're beyond that now. I think we're talking about the need for change. And if we hadn't known it before tonight, we know it now. We're being reminded. There is a strong need for change. Now, Fred, sitting over in the corner, teaches a very well-attended class, so well-attended he has to do it twice a day. And he's talking to people about themselves. And one of the things he's asking people to confront is how tough it is to change. He cites the example of the guy who walks down the same street, takes the same turn, and falls in the same hole every day. And even after he's got a map. And it takes a whole lot of resolve to just decide he won't even walk down that street anymore. He'll go out another door in order to avoid it. I hope that we are all persuaded that the change has to take place. I'm assuming, though, that most of us have church backgrounds. And with church backgrounds, we're forever being reminded of that old problem of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. That's always there. And that's what's involved in change. Now, what are the practical consequences of this? There are some people who just love to come here to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to be stimulated. And a lot of good folks, and they're not all old farts either. Some of them are just tired, and they like to come someplace where they can sit down and be themselves. But what's the obligation of Holden as an institution to these people, many of whom have been funding this place, and whose parents came here, and whose children are now coming? But still, change has to take place, just as it has to take place in our towns and our neighborhoods. Now, how do we do it? Do we just raise so much fuss and crash through and say, well, there you are, we've done it? Or do we try to persuade? Do we try to educate? I really don't know. All I know is that at the expense of inconvenience and irritation and mistakes, we have to make the change. The most practical thing I would think of would be to those in authority and say, it's got to happen. How do you want it to happen? Because it's got to happen. Do you want to do it nice? Or do you want to do it rough? It's got to happen because Holden is a part. It's just, we like to call it a village, kind of like Disney World. But it's really a part of the world. And it, like everything else, has to change. How can we make it happen? Anybody got some ideas? I'd like to hear it. I'd like to help.
It sounds like a topic for next week's forum. There's one gentleman has had his hand up back here. And
it sounded like a wonderful closing comment, so I don't think I will follow on
that. Okay. It is after 10 o'clock now, and I have promised that we'd like to make it easy for people to leave gracefully at 10 o'clock if you are planning on bed or agreed to meet somebody. But you don't have to leave the room, and you don't have to stop the conversation. But I would like to thank the three of you for laying these things out for us so helpfully and clearly, and thanks to everybody for contributing and for listening and for being here.
Can I ask a question? Sure. I have friends who went to Women's Church, which was a kind of an ad hoc deal. I've read about it. The last day, they were making a real effort to be multicultural. And they were having all kinds of different rites and rituals and using drums from different cultures and that sort of thing. And on the last day, I think they were American Indian who stood up and just really raised hell because these white folks were taking over their culture and messing around with things that the whites had absolutely no business doing. And that was, they felt this was another form of, I think in this case of growing up, their culture. And I'd like to know, I was interested in your remarks to the effect that no one here, the whites here, don't use any of the, for example, the downs or do you have those feelings? I mean, I think it made me feel really nervous about taking on or looking at parts of other cultures and other ways of doing things that I think are really neat. And I would like to do that sort of thing. Well, but I don't want to offend anybody.
I've read articles about that where Native Americans will say, you'll take our spirituality, but you won't give us any political power. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a danger of that when you continually do African music in your church and there's not an African around. You know, when you continually do things from Native America, yet you never see a Native American in your church.
Mm-hmm. Or you do black gospel music.
But why do I have to like drums? I don't like drums. And has nothing to do with color. I don't care where the drums are from. I just don't like them.
Well, you don't have to. I'm not saying you have to like
it. I mean, it's like it's pushed on here. You have to like it.
No, you don't have to like
it. I'm old fashioned. I like the organ. I mean, to me, that's church, you know.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to. You don't have to like it, but you have to. I think you have to have a tolerance.
Oh, sure.
You know, and I, clearly there are some people who come here who don't have a tolerance for anything.
I heard what I thought was a fascinating comment on public radio from San Luis College where they're talking about ethnic music. And one of the announcers said that he couldn't think of anything more ethnic than an Anglican boys choir. Because it comes out of a particular culture. And I think part of the issue is that those groups that have power are the ones who assume that they don't have to make any accommodations and wonder, you know, what's going on with those other people. So that's why when we go over to Turkey, we're no longer in power, and we say, how do I make sure I don't offend these folks? But while we're here, we're in power, and we say, well, let's help these folks get assimilated into our culture. And I don't know where that is going, but I wanted to connect it back with this issue of power, because I think that I really like your definition of racism as prejudice connected with power.
I think it's all about power.
It is, yeah, it is about power.
Well, it's about power, and it's about fear.
Fear, yeah.
It's about fear of being different, and fear of not being accepted. One thing that I've been trying to teach this week while I've been here, and while I hope to teach next week, is that awareness comes really slowly. And we are all used to seeing the world in a certain way. We are products of our past. And if change is to be something that we use and something that we look forward to, it begins in little ways. The smallest amount of change takes the greatest amount of courage. And if you want to have crisis change, where you change everything right away, then you're going to have crisis management when that change is implemented. So I came in here, and I'm Catholic. I felt like a minority. When I arrived here last Saturday, I heard we're doing Vespers. I didn't know what that was. I thought, we're doing Rachmaninoff? I didn't know. And so I go in, and we're doing music that is international and global. And I'm a musician, and I was amazed and pleased. And I'm seeing drums, and Mary and Tom are doing things with music that I've only dreamed of doing in the Catholic Church, because there's a certain way it's, quote, supposed to be done. And I'm hearing tonight talk of power, that it's a matter of getting influence, and you've got to have the influence, and it has to be fair. But it's based on fear. And I can't say that I'm not prejudiced and that I'm unprejudiced. I don't know. I only know where I've been. And I only know that I want to be more human. I would like to see all reference to color and people of color and white and black be dropped. Because what happens when I cut myself, I bleed red. That's who I am. The color of my skin, that's genetic. I can't change it. All I can do is be more compassionate and try to understand where you are and help you to understand where I am and meet in the middle. And when I came to Holden, I didn't ever know about Holden Village until last December when somebody mentioned it to me. I didn't even know it existed. And I think Tom had a good point that Holden really does. We're like a little micro community. That what we do here really does reflect what's going on in the outside world. And when I first heard this topic about racism, I wasn't really sure, well, what are we really talking about? Because I don't like the idea that there are separate races because of color. But there are different cultures. And until we become aware of our own dispositions and our own internal prejudices, which may not have much to do with color, it may be more cultural, and we overcome our fear of each other, we're going to have problems. And what I've seen here is that, like Tom said, there has been a change. There has been a difference made, and it's been maybe small and slight, but that small difference, that small course correction will take us to places uncharted that we've never known. And I hope we get there intact.
That's a good note to close on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?